And now for reading and writing and radio.
Today's Reading and Writing and Radio has six special guests. From Ball Chatham, we have Mike Ooten, who is in Trish McGill's fifth grade, Juan Choi and Emily Gooding, who are in Peggy Goodwin's fifth grade, Rod Etter from Rosemary Kennedy's fifth grade class. From Glenwood Junior High's sixth grade Chatham, we have B.J. Ladd, and from Little Flower in Springfield, Jane Ford's fifth grade, Andy Wells. And our final guest is Richard Durbin, a member of the United States House of Representatives in Washington from Illinois' 20th Congressional District, in which district are many of the schools and the homes of all of you listening. I'm Jackie Jackson, as you know, Reading and Writing and Radio's host. I welcome all of you here to this studio, and I'm now going to turn our program over to Dick and to you kids. Here's your chance. What topics would you like to talk about with our congressman?
Jackie, thanks for having us here this morning, and this is a good group. We've already had some preliminary discussions. The one good piece of news for everybody is that they're all Bear fans, everybody here.
So we won't have any arguments.
No arguments over football. Of course, we're taping this right before the Super Bowl, and we all hope we have a big smile on our faces in a couple of days when the score is announced. But I'm looking forward to the questions this morning.
Now, does one of you have a beginning question that you'd like to ask?
Well, I kind of wondered about, like, the women in Congress. Are there a lot of them, or is there, like, as many as there are men? Like, do you see a lot of them around?
No, Emily. Unfortunately, when you look at the number of women in the United States and consider the fact that the House of Representatives is supposed to represent the American population, there are very few women in Congress. I think the total is less than 30 out of 435. Of course, a few more have been added over the years. But historically, we have just not elected as many women to Congress. I think that's changing. I think we're finding that women are running to be governors. We have a woman who is a governor, for example, in Kentucky nowadays. We have women who are candidates for the United States Senate. And we have women who are being elected to government positions all around the country. So my guess is that the day may come when we hear about President Emily or President Mary or whoever it might be and not be a bit surprised.
Go ahead.
Juan?
To speak up.
Well, how did you get to become a congressman?
A lot of people think that I might have answered an ad in a newspaper, but that isn't the way it worked. Every 2 years, of course, we have elections for the United States House of Representatives in every even-numbered year. And anyone who is 25 years old and a citizen of the United States can file petitions to run for office. A petition is just a piece of paper with the signatures of all your neighbors on it. And if they sign up and say, I'd like to help so-and-so or Dick Durbin, whoever it might be, get his name on the ballot, then you qualify. You don't have to pay any money, and you just have to go forward at that point and file your petitions, which I did. Of course, then there's a long campaign. In Illinois, our state, one of the longest in the nation. I decided in 1982 to run for this office, but I might tell you that I had run for office before unsuccessfully. In fact, I'd lost three elections before I was finally elected in 1982. So I guess the lesson there is either the people get tired of seeing your name on the ballot or, frankly, if you keep trying, eventually you can succeed. So that's how I got interested. I've always liked government and been involved in it for quite a while.
Well, how is the U.S. dealing with terrorism?
Andy, that's a problem we've all got. I guess you heard in the news just a month or so ago the unfortunate story about the young girl, probably close to your age, who was traveling with her parents in Rome, an American citizen. And she was on her way to take a trip with her parents, and a terrorist came into an airport terminal, rolled in a hand grenade, and it exploded and turned loose a machine gun, and it killed her. And unfortunately, in Rome and Vienna, in that experience, some 19 people lost their lives, five Americans. I don't think we're doing as good a job as we could on that. All of us like to think if we're traveling with our families or going around the world that it's going to be safe. The difficulty that we've got now is that there are some people out there that are just not mentally stable, I don't believe, and they are prepared to kill innocent people and they're prepared to lose their own lives. We see lots of things on television, don't we, about terrorism. In fact, we see a lot of shows about it, and we forget that it could happen to anybody. So what we're trying to do in this country is to punish either the individuals or the countries that are involved in terrorism but to make certain that the United States does it in a just way, in a fair way. We don't want to be guilty of killing innocent people in the process either, and that makes it very difficult. But I think what we've got to do is get other nations, the French, the Germans, others that are friends and allies who have a similar concern, to join with us. Make airports safer. Make sure that if you and your family wanted to travel overseas, that you know you could do so in safety.
What if terrorists came to Springfield and the police caught them? What punishment would you think would be fit for them?
Well, what it basically boils down to is that you've got to make sure that the punishment fits the crime. If a person has been guilty of taking another person's life under the laws in the state of Illinois, they can be subject to the most severe of punishments. In fact, we even have a death penalty in the state, although it's very seldom applied. I would certainly believe that they should be taken through our court system and held accountable for their acts as any other person would be. And similarly, if you and your family were traveling overseas and got hurt, I would hope that the country that arrested the person that hurt you would send them to the United States for a trial so that they would be held accountable for what they have done. It's only fair that they answer for their crimes.
Do you think of all the terrorism, if there ever was a whole lot of it, could there be a World War III?
Rob, that's a concern we have. Let me give you an example. Have any of you here heard of Mr. Gaddafi? You have, haven't you? He's a leader in Libya. And we've seen a lot of pictures of him on magazines and the like. Libya is a very small country, about a population of 3 million. The United States has a population of over 220 million. We have all the military firepower in the world, probably one of the strongest nations in the world, and the biggest armies and the biggest navies. And here is this country with a 3 million population. And some people would say to me at a town meeting or call me on the phone and say, why don't you go in and strike this Gaddafi and do something to him? I guess the big question we have in our mind is, what can we do to really stop him? And one of the things we're concerned about is just the question you raised. What if we would take some military action against Libya, against Colonel Gaddafi? Who would join him and support him? Some other countries of the world might do it. In fact, the Soviet Union might get involved. And all of a sudden, if the Soviet Union's on the other side and we're on this side, we have to worry about not just Gaddafi and his armies, but about the possibility of a nuclear war. What if someone used a nuclear weapon? So we've got to measure our response on this and make sure what we do is limited and non-military if possible, because none of us want to get to the point where we're involved with nuclear weapons.
What do you think about nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors in the United States?
Well, you see, the nuclear, there are two good questions you raised there. On the nuclear reactors, those of us who live in this area of the country have come to know of the Clinton nuclear power plant, which has been under construction for a long time. And let me tell you, if your parents went out shopping and said they were going to spend $400 and ended up spending $4,000, they would consider it a pretty bad shopping trip, and that's just about what's happened with the Clinton power plant. It was supposed to cost $400 million, and now it's getting close to $4 billion that it's going to cost. So we find that it's a very expensive undertaking, and I think if we had to do it all over again, we'd wish that they hadn't built this plant, because it may mean that our electrical rates will go up, and your parents will come in and say, turn out the lights in your bedroom, turn off that stereo, you're using up all the electricity, and it's going to cost a fortune. So the nuclear power question is one of whether we can afford it and whether it's safe. You know, basic question, would you want a nuclear reactor in your backyard so that you could look out the window and see it there? Well, a lot of people say, wait a minute, I'm not sure I would. It might not be safe. And we're trying to have government regulation to make sure that all Americans feel safe. Nuclear waste, you know, when it's all over, when the nuclear reactors created the electricity, there's radioactive waste left that has a life, a dangerous life, of over 1,000 years. Where are you going to bury it? What are you going to do with it? Where will it be safe? Lots of questions, still unresolved. The other question that you raised about the nuclear arms race is one that troubles me more than any other issue that I face as a congressman. If we can't bring that under control so that you young men and young lady here have an opportunity to live a life in peace and safety, then there's nothing else we're doing that's very important as far as I'm concerned. That's the number one thing we've got to worry about. I'm glad that finally we're sitting down with the Soviet Union and talking. For a long time, we didn't even do that. Rob?
Well, with all the nuclear
weapons and everything, and President Reagan talking to the Gorbachev guy, I hear that they might remove all the weapons.
You know, there was a great suggestion on January the 15th, and I keep that date in my mind because I hope that it goes down in the history of the world, when the Secretary General of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, suggested that we start phasing out and eliminating our nuclear weapons. Think about that. What if we lived in a world where there were no nuclear weapons, or only a few that we kept close control over? Instead, we live in a world where we build a new nuclear missile every day, a missile that could destroy millions of lives and really destroy the life on Earth as we know it. I think that Mr. Gorbachev has made an interesting proposal, and I was really happy that President Reagan said he thought it was constructive. In other words, he thought it would help if they sat down and discussed that proposal. I couldn't think of a better present for the president to leave us in his final term in office than to really move us toward world peace and to try to phase down all these nuclear weapons and all the money we spend on it. Think about this. One-third of the money spent in Washington, D.C. goes to our military. Now, of course, we want a strong defense. We'd never want to lose a war. But if we could find a way to take that money and put it into things like education, to make sure that every school in America had a computer in the classroom and that kids had an opportunity to learn, to make certain that you had the best possible education and never had to turn down the possibility of going to a school because you didn't have the money, these are things that make America strong, too, and I think we ought to be moving in that direction. Mike?
What do you think of the Star Wars program?
Well, the Star Wars program is President's proposal, which is interesting. I mean, it's a fascinating idea. When I was your age, people would say, what do you think about sending a man to the moon? And you'd kind of laugh, and you'd say, oh, come on, we're not going to get a man on the moon. We couldn't get somebody up there, and we'd never get him back. And it sounded like a crazy idea. President Kennedy came along in 1960 when he was elected and said, we're going to do that. The United States is going to put a man on the moon. And off we went. And now not only do we have men going to the moon and astronauts going to outer space, we have all sorts of people joining them. In fact, they're training now to send a teacher to outer space. Now, I don't want anybody here suggesting that their teacher should go to outer space unless they want to. But the point is that the space program has got a lot of positive things, and many people were skeptical of it to start with. So I don't want to suggest that we can't do what the president's proposed. His Star Wars proposal would try to create something like a shield over the United States to protect us from nuclear attack. But I'm afraid to say that most of the scientists, in fact, all of the scientists I've spoken to in Washington, are very skeptical. They are very doubtful the United States can build this kind of a thing. And they also ask us, can we afford it? Think about this. $1 trillion would be spent on that one military project. That's more than the entire budget of the United States government in 1 year now. So I'd like to see us move toward a point where we protect ourselves, but I think that concept hasn't been developed and could be very, very expensive. Emily?
But do you think that either country really would start a World War III? Because, like, we know that if we started and we sent, if we did something to them, you know, like a bomb or something, like, we know that they could do that right back to us.
That's called, you're right, and that's maybe the reason why for 40 years with all this nuclear capability we haven't had a war, because we know we can destroy them, they know we could come back and be destroyed by them as well. So it's a situation where it's called deterrence, where it stops us from doing these sorts of things. But the problem is you're never sure of every circumstance, and we're never sure that every country in the world that has a nuclear weapon would be as responsible or at least would have the same feelings. Right now, unfortunately, the United States and Soviet Union are not the only countries in the world with nuclear weapons. There are lots of other ones, and they could start something. So we've got to really move toward the day of eliminating these weapons and eliminating that possibility and stop spending all the money, if we can, on these weapons. Yes, BJ.
What do you think about, like, satellite dishes and the way, like, things like HBO are scrambling and stuff? And, like, because we live out in the country, and we can't get cable or anything. And, like, in the city, you can get HBO for real low, and then out in the country, if you want to get it on satellite dish, you have to pay a lot more.
We're trying to find out a reasonable way of resolving this problem. The people who put the satellites up in the air that send these television signals back to Earth say, well, we didn't design those satellites and send that signal back and spend all that money so that people who are not paying the monthly charge can get it free. And, of course, people who are living as you are in the country are saying, wait a minute, you got those satellites up in space with a lot of government help, too, and we'd like to think that we have access to that kind of programming. We're trying to find a way to resolve this so that there can be some contribution or participation by people who have satellite dishes, for example, and that they can receive these signals. I think it does something for America, which is healthy. There was a time, not too many years ago, where if you lived out in the country in America, you were removed from virtually all contact. Well, along came the radio and the telephone, and people started being more conversant with one another, communicating with one another. Now we're moving to the day of the satellite dish. For instance, the day before yesterday, I was in Washington, D.C., and I was presiding over the House of Representatives. I got to sit up in the big chair, and I had the gavel, and I was presiding over it. And that's carried all over the United States on a network called C-SPAN. Yeah. So that the do you get C-SPAN on your cables? That means that the people of the United States of America have a real opportunity. Some of them may think it's a boring program. I happen to like it because I'm on there once in a while. But it's a great opportunity for people all around the country to see how their laws are made. Some people think it's great. Others look at it and say, you can do a better job, Congressman. But that's good, isn't it? It isn't just something where you read in a textbook. Yes, Rob?
Well, what is Illinois doing to help the farmers and stuff?
Rob, that's a good question, because I think that's something we're all worried about. We one of the things about Illinois, when you look at it, as to why it is a great state that it is a basis of we have great farmland and a great history of producing the world's food and fiber. And now we've got some serious problems facing our farmers. Many of them are not going to survive. In other words, they'll lose their farms and have to find other work. I hate to see that happen. In 1900, 86 years ago, one out of every three Americans was a farmer. And if they asked you when you got up at school what you wanted to be when you grew up, one out of three people would say, I want to be a farmer like my father. And the young ladies would say, I'd like to live on a farm because that's my lifestyle and I'm used to it. But things have been changing in America. People are moving off the farm year in, year out. Now we have only 2 or 3% of the people who are farmers. We're worried that unless this crisis is brought under control, we'll lose even more farmers. There'll be a concentration of ownership, and we won't have as many farmers producing. So we're trying to create programs at the government level that'll help farmers get through the tough times. The problem we have is that we're really in terrible financial shape in Washington. We have a big debt at the moment. We're trying to bring that under control so that you don't end up carrying it. Juan.
Well, about the farmers, like, losing money so they go out of business. Like, there's more and more every day, like, going out of business. So I wonder, like, where the United States will get more food.
Well, I think that you have to look at it this way. There will probably be someone who will take over that farmland. Let's say a farm family should go broke today and have to sell their farmland and all their equipment and their house, and then they have to move. If they sell it, they'll sell it to someone who will probably take over the land and start to farm it and raise the crops as well. But then we've got fewer people doing it. There won't be as many families out there doing it. And that concerns me, too. I like the idea that we've got competition where people are competing with one another to find new ways to grow things and to sell it to the lowest price. And as a nation, in supplying the world and supplying America with what we need to eat, we want to keep that level of competition. If we lose more and more farmers, we could lose that level. So I think we've got to do what we can to keep those families in place on the farm and producing. You have a follow-up question on that, too?
But then, if a family that owns a farm like goes out of business and somebody buys it, they're probably going to make it into, like, probably build buildings or.
Some of them will do that, particularly if the farm's near the city. But if they're way out in the country, the likelihood is that they'll just keep farming and they'll try to get more efficient and use bigger tractors and use more machinery. Fewer people will be involved. Andy, you've been trying to get a question in here. Go ahead.
Will we ever see a better control of drugs that now exists in the United States?
I hope so. You know, that is one of the most serious problems. I have seen so many people, young people too, whose lives have been just wrecked because they made a decision which was wrong in their lives. They made a decision that they were going to try drugs at some point, whether it was marijuana or cocaine or something like that. And I used to be a lawyer before I was elected to Congress, and I would have young men and women come in to see me, and it was a tragedy. They had big plans about going on to college and a career ahead of them, and they'd been arrested for using drugs. And they really faced the possibility that they would not only bring real sadness to their family for what they'd been through, but that their own lives would be affected by this. And I can't think of a bigger tragedy. What can we do about it? We got to do several things. First, we got to educate people. We got to convince everybody in this room, my kids and the kids in the classrooms across America, that that's just the wrong way to go, that you got to say no when that opportunity presents itself. And someday, somewhere in your life, the opportunity is going to present itself. You got to say no. It's wrong. It's not good for me, and it's not something I want to get involved in. Then we've got to go after the people who are abusing them, people who are selling these drugs, trying to sell them on playgrounds and at schools around the country. I mean, these are the lowest forms of folks who really don't care about the future of young people. They're trying to make a dollar, and they don't care if you go to jail or make your family feel ashamed of what you've done. They're just there to make a dollar. So we've got to go after those folks. And even to the countries where the drugs are manufactured. Bolivia, for example, where they make they grow the coca leaf, which is used to make cocaine. Well, the natives in Bolivia pull the leaves off the trees and chew on them all day. And it isn't the same kind of effect as a person who uses cocaine. But unfortunately, a lot of gangster-type people have come in and are producing cocaine out of these leaves, and they're shipping it to the United States. We're trying to shut down that international trade as well. So it's really three levels: education, law enforcement in this country, try to dry up the sources of those funds or those drugs overseas. Who hasn't asked a question for a while? Mike, why don't you chime in here?
Okay, I read your recent letter to taxpayers yesterday, and I was reading an article about bringing down natural gas prices, and I came across the phrase, well, sort of, black billing in parentheses. And what does that mean?
It's pretty complicated. What it boils down to is we're trying to find ways where individual consumers, like your mom and dad and my wife and I, when we buy our natural gas to heat our homes, that we can do it at the cheapest possible price. Let's consider this possibility. You've got a bright red sweater on there today, and let's say that you went out to a shopping mall to buy a red sweater, and you had several stores to go to. I'll mention a few that we're all familiar with. You could have gone to Sears or Bressmer's or Penny's or Montgomery Ward or Famous and Barr, and you go there and you look for the cheapest sweater you can that really satisfies you. You got five stores to look at, called competition. And you find out that there's one that's very expensive at one of the stores. You say, I'm not going there. I'm going next door. I'm going to save a dollar. That's called the free market. And as consumers, we want more of that in America. We want that choice. We want price competition. But look what happens when your mom and dad get their gas bill at home. Look at the prices on there. And I guess if you saw them open them, sometimes you say, oh, my goodness, here it comes again. Mom's going to say it again. And she says, oh, no, look at this gas bill. We're going to have to turn down the thermostat again. The problem your mom has, and most people have, is you can't shop around at that point. You can't say, I'm going to go off somewhere else and buy some gas. Natural gas comes to your house through a little pipe underground, and there's only one supplier, so you're stuck. We're all stuck. Block billing is an attempt to try to get some competition in there to make sure that we bring down those prices of gas by having different gas wells competing with one another to provide our utility companies with the lowest price gas. And that's what I'm pushing for. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. I also have a follow-up question. Also in your letter, you were talking about your 156th, 57th, and 58th meetings. I'd like to know what goes on at these meetings.
Mike, I want you to come out to one of my town meetings, and we advertise them and have them in the area. A lot of things go on there. People come out who've never seen a congressman before. A lot of people in the small towns come out and can't believe I'm there. They said, Dick Durbin, what are you doing in this town? Nobody's ever been here before. What we're trying to do is to really bring government down to the level where people can get involved in it. BJ mentioned earlier the satellite dishes. Some of you have seen C-SPAN, where people see it. I think you have to take it a step beyond that. You have to be there in these, we've done them in grocery stores, we've done them in service stations, we've done them at town halls. Be there in the communities where people can come out and look you in the eye. If you were congressman, they say, Congressman Mike, we just saw your vote out there last week, and we disagree with you. Now explain why you did it. Now that's what our government's all about. And if they agree with me, or they think I gave a reasonable answer, they might support me for re-election. If they disagree, they might support my opponent. But the town meetings give us that opportunity. I can explain what's going on, and people can ask important questions.
Okay.
Let me see. Who hasn't asked for a while? Rob, your turn.
Okay. If we were to ever have a nuclear war, do you think the world could be destroyed?
I'm afraid it could be. Not just a matter of the missiles that would be detonated and the bombs that would go off, but something that's called nuclear winter could happen. Have you heard anything about that? Well, what would happen, they're afraid, is if there was a nuclear war, it would throw up into our atmosphere, that level above the Earth, all sorts of debris and dust and radioactivity. Now, that would create something like a filter that you might see the sun being filtered through. And as the sun is filtered through that, there is less and less heat and light coming down to the Earth. And as there's less heat and light, what do you think is going to be affected by it?
We can't live because we don't get the sunlight.
Don't get the sunlight? What else, Mike?
Our plants don't grow.
The plants don't grow. We don't have enough to eat. So the winter, the nuclear winter, like we have outside now, where we don't have the kind of sun we need to grow our crops, would become almost a permanent condition. Or maybe it would just be for a year. But think about that, that we couldn't grow anything on this earth for a year. You've all seen the pictures coming from Ethiopia of all those poor children and adults who are losing their lives by starvation. That sort of thing, unfortunately, could happen in the entire world. And that's why what might be just a bomb exchange between two countries could affect the entire world and the ability of people to live. Andy?
What is the world trying to do about the poor people in Ethiopia?
Well, we're trying to do some things. I wish Ethiopia was our only problem in the world to solve. Unfortunately, there are many countries around the world where people are in similar circumstances. And you may not see it on the television at night, but all across some parts of Africa, they have had droughts for long periods of time. They have had areas like Bangladesh, which is a country you'll find on the map as you go back to school, where people have been starving and trying to survive. So what do we do about that? Well, a lot of people say, hey, that's their problem. That's not our problem. We got to take care of America first. Well, we want to take care of America. There's no question. But we're a different kind of people. We're a different nation. We help people get back on their feet. And I think we're proud of that as Americans. So what we try to do is say, if we've got a little extra wheat or corn, let's send it over to those folks and help them to get through this very difficult time. It's not only the right thing to do as human beings worried about human beings, I think it's the right thing for our country, isn't it? Doesn't it send a message out that we are caring people, that we can be their friends, we can help them in the future? That's why I'm proud to be part of this country, and why I hope when you grow up that that same tradition continues of helping people. So we try to send them food. We try to do something else. We try to get them to the point where they can grow their own food. We send over people who are very smart in agriculture and irrigation, for example, and say, let's take this desert and turn it into something where we can grow food. And by giving people that knowledge and that expertise, they move them closer to the day when they can survive. BJ.
What do you think about, like, burning fossil fuels for electricity and the pollution?
That's the problem, is the pollution. Here's the difficulty we have. Where you and I are living right now in Illinois, we are right on top of something, a great resource, one of the greatest deposits and reserves of this resource in the world. Do you know what it is?
Coal.
Coal. Everywhere you turn in this area, there's lots of coal. But what's the problem with that coal? I think you were getting to that point.
Creates pollution.
Creates pollution. It's got a lot of sulfur in it. So when you burn this coal, you get heat from it, and that heat can help you generate electricity and a lot of things. But up at the top of that smokestack, sulfur's coming out. And when that sulfur mixes in the atmosphere with oxygen, it becomes sulfur dioxide. And it moves closer to the point where it's like sulfuric acid, which is something you're going to run into when you get into chemistry, or maybe you've studied it in science. Sulfuric acid can kill things. It can kill plants and animals, fish and streams and the like. So here we are heating ourselves, but sending something out of the smokestack that can cause a problem. So what do we do about it? A couple things we can do about it. One is we've got to put what they call scrubbers on these smokestacks that scrub the smoke before it heads out in the air. It takes out that sulfur, takes out the dangerous chemicals in it to make sure that no one around the world is going to suffer because of what we burn to heat our homes. And secondly, we've got to find ways to use our coal, ways that might be efficient and environmentally safe. I'm working on a coal gasification plant for the area that would be just that. Would be a way of using a lot of this coal, putting a lot of people back to work, making sure that our parents and friends and neighbors have an opportunity to work, but do it in a safe way. Juan?
Well, every year the Americans send money to the Philippines.
Yes.
To support the people and all that. But I think, like, the government of the Philippines are taking more money than the people are.
That's a problem that's being resolved even as we speak in an election in that country, a really controversial election. between the president, Ferdinand Marcos, who's been president there for over 20 years, and Corazon Aquino, who is a woman who is running for president. Emily, see, they've got women running in the Philippines even before the United States. And it's a real controversy as to whether President Marcos has been fair to his people. And there are many who believe that having been in office that long, that there needs to be a change, and some of the things he's done are not fair. And the United States is involved in the Philippines, very much involved. And you know why we're involved so much in the Philippines? Why we're so concerned about the Philippines? Why, what?
I think, like, it's near the Soviet Union.
Well, it's near Asia, and and being as close as it is to Southeast Asia, we need to have a military base there.
Yeah.
In fact, a naval base, it's very important to us. So it has a military importance to the United States, and as a result, what we have tried to do is establish a friendly relationship with whatever government is in power. So I would say you got to be careful, as you've mentioned, that we aren't supporting governments that are not fair to their people just because of military purposes. What we got to make sure now is that the Philippines has a fair election. If there's any way we can help them to have one, let their people elect leaders that really represent them. Mike?
Well, since we're school children, right, I was just wondering, were you very smart as a child?
My mother thought I was so smart. No, to be honest with you, I suppose that I wasn't number one in my class most of the time. But I tell you this, it was an interesting thing about education. It taught me a lot of basic things that I've used over and over again. Let me give you some ideas. One is just the interest in reading things. You know, it's so easy now to turn on that radio, and God bless radio because we're on it right now, or to turn on the television and to just kind of waft away and to kind of doze off and to watch the videos and forget about the rest of the world. That's a mistake, and I tell my kids that too. And what you basically have to do is to get up in that morning and take a look at the paper, find out what's going on in the world so that you know, find a magazine that's interesting to you, read some books. You know, if I got anything out of school, it was just that curiosity. You're curious. Where's the Philippines? What's going on in the Philippines? I want to know more about it. What about nuclear war? Who is the leader of the Soviet Union now? I want to know those things. If you've got that curiosity and follow through and pick up that information, you'll be getting more out of school now that'll help you later on than any memorization of multiplication tables. Yes?
I also have a follow-up question. Were you involved with any sports in high school or junior high?
I was a pretty bad football player. I didn't make the first team, but I liked playing sports, and I got involved in a lot of sports. I played almost all of them. I wasn't great at them. But my son and I have an opportunity to play a little backyard basketball and golf together. And I think sports are great, and I encourage you to get involved in something like that. It helps you keep your body in shape. Emily?
Well, I would think that you would get a lot of mail, being who you are.
Well, you're right.
But what topics do you get the most mail on?
People write to me a lot about the problems we've talked about here today. They write a lot about nuclear war. They write a lot about the economy, utility bills. Get a lot of questions about it. Why are my utility bills so high? Do something about that. People express their opinions about whether they think President Reagan is right or wrong on an issue. They'll ask me why I voted one way or the other. Or they'll ask if there's a law on satellite dishes, for example. We get a lot of letters on satellite dishes. They'll ask me if there's a law pending or one that we can bring into Congress that would change that situation. We get about 100 letters a day, and about 65 of them are from my district. And we do personal responses to all of them. And that's a lot of mail, I can tell you. Rob?
Well, being all the news there is in every day, you think all of it on it is real? Are they lying? Are they telling the truth?
I would say that in the network news, ABC, CBS, NBC, and, of course, the PBS, Public Broadcasting System, are very accurate and can be trusted to give you good information. Now, as I've done before, if you take the time to watch the same newscast each night and see how the story is delivered on CBS or how it is on NBC, it might be a little bit different. It's a human being interpreting a fact, and it may come out a little differently. But I think by and large that there is real accuracy in the news. We've got to keep our eye on them to make sure that continues. But I think right now they do a pretty good job. Yes, Andy.
Are you in favor or against the seatbelt law in Illinois, and do you think there should be a seatbelt law all over the United States?
Andy, I would tell you first that the law was passed by the state government here in Springfield and not out in Washington. But I think it's a good law, even though it's very controversial. It's a good law because right now my children, who are not little kids anymore, but they're driving cars, for example, get in a car and buckle up their seatbelts. When I was their age, I never thought of it. If they get in an accident, their chances of surviving and having fewer injuries are much better than mine ever were. And I've seen, unfortunately, the young people who've been involved in accidents and didn't wear seatbelts. Some of them are hopelessly paralyzed for the rest of their life. Some of them have injuries that they'll have to carry forever. So as uncomfortable as it might be for a few seconds getting in a car to buckle that belt, it's a smart thing to do. And if we couldn't get it done by just telling people it was smart, at least the creation of the law has more people using it. We found in states that it had those laws in effect, fewer people are dying and fewer people are getting injured. That is encouraging because it means for a lot of people, they'll have a second chance in life now to live beyond that accident, a very normal life, have a family and a happy life ahead of them. I think that's a good thing to do. BJ.
Do you think your job affects your family?
Oh, I'm afraid it does. I spend an awful lot of time traveling. Last year, 1985, I made 47 round trips between Washington, D.C. and Springfield, Illinois. My family lives here in Springfield. I spend a lot of time in airports. I just came in yesterday. Got in through Chicago at about 5 o'clock in the evening. Went home, said hello to my kids. Picked up my wife and my daughter, and we went out. We played racquetball at the Y, and I try my best to stay close to them and involved. But the point is, I was gone 4 days last week, and I'm not wild about that. Your parents were probably home last week. I hope they were. If they were, they had a chance to answer some of your questions personally. Luckily, my kids are getting a little older, so I may not be needed as much on a day-to-day basis. But on a personal level, there's a lot of sacrifice involved in it. Let me see here. Who has it? Mike, why don't you ask the next question?
Okay. Well, you've been to the White House, right?
Yes.
Well, I've heard that the White House looks gray from the outside.
It's probably pollution and smog that you see. But it is white, and it has a little bit of a gray tinge to it. But it's really a fascinating place to visit. The interesting thing about the White House is that 20 or 30 years ago, there were no fences around the White House. Well, I guess it might go back further than that, maybe 40 years ago. And people didn't think anything of walking and sitting on the lawn of the White House to eat a sandwich on their way back to work. But security has changed so much now that they have big gates and fences around there, and all sorts of guards, and they're afraid that with all the problems we've had with terrorism and violence, that they've got to be more careful. But it's a great historical place. And what's been said by president after president, President Reagan and all of his predecessors, it isn't their house. It's the American people's house, where the presidents are given 4 years to live. They only are renters there for a four-year period of time. Hope you can see it someday. Go ahead.
Have you ever spent the night in there?
No, I haven't. I'd like to do that sometime. There's a bedroom called the Lincoln Bedroom, incidentally, in the White House, where the President Lincoln and his family stayed that many, many years ago, over 100 years ago. I've seen it and on tours, and I'd like to have a chance to spend the night there sometime. Maybe somebody will invite me. Go ahead.
Well, if you did spend the night in the Lincoln Room, would you believe that his ghost would show up? Because it's been said in books that his ghost has been knocking on the door and it's been seen sleeping in the beds.
I'm anxious to find out. I'd like to ask Mr. Lincoln a question or two, you see, because he was a congressman from the same district that I represent back in 1847, and I'd like to ask him what it was like to be a congressman back there. Emily?
Well, I saw something in the paper the other day, and it was about how over the years they had kept moving the capital of Illinois north, and now, it's kind of going towards Springfield towards Chicago since Governor Thompson moved there. Do you think that that will happen?
I hope not. I think it's important that we maintain the capital in Springfield. Chicago is a very important city and very important to the state of Illinois. But putting a capital in a central location like Springfield means that people all over the state have access to their state capital, and it certainly means that there's more sensitivity and understanding of the problems we have downstate by keeping the capital here. I certainly want to make sure that this was the last move for the state capital and that Springfield is where it stays for a long time. I can't think. It's an interesting question, but I can't think of another state. I wonder when the last state was that moved their state capital. It used to be done pretty regularly, as you mentioned, because we were colonizing all these different areas and settling in them.
Yeah.
That'd be a good question to look up in your American history course. BJ?
What do you think about colleges and their
and how the prices are going up.
Oh, it scares me. I've got to start paying for that. I've got a daughter who's a senior in high school. Now I'm looking around, and she says, oh, Dad, here's a great school, and it's only $15,000 a year.
That's what I'm paying right now.
Isn't that terrible,
Elliott
Jackie?
Dartmouth, yeah.
Yeah, it gets pretty expensive.
It's pretty hard on you.
Yeah, and even at the University of Illinois, if you're lucky, if you can get admitted there and it's a great school too, it's still going to cost $7,000 or $8,000 a year. Problem we've got is with our federal budget problems out in Washington, we've had to cut back on the student loan programs for kids. I borrowed every penny I spent to get through college, money I couldn't earn or scholarships. I had to borrow the rest of it from the federal government. It gave me an opportunity. I don't know what I'd be doing today if I hadn't finished that way. So what you got to do is keep your grades up so you might qualify for a scholarship. Get to work, part-time jobs and summer jobs, save up some money. Try to help your parents come to an understanding is the right place for you. And you've got to understand, boy, some of these expenses are just awful. Let me see who hasn't asked for a while. Andy?
Do you believe that Illinois will have a new governor since Governor Thompson has been going up to Chicago a lot?
You know, Andy, that's almost a political question. Maybe I ought to duck that question. I think this coming November, the folks will get a decision between Adlai Stevenson and Jim Thompson. I would say this, Governor Thompson's been in longer than any governor in the history of the state of Illinois, 10 years. And, of course, he had a new constitution in there, which gave him a two-year term at one point. He's been a very popular governor. It's unusual for a governor to serve that long. The people in November will decide whether they want him for another 4 years, whether he's done a good enough job to keep Illinois under control for the next 4 years. But it should be a pretty hot contest. 4 years ago when these two men squared off, it came down to a handful of votes that decided it. And I'm not going to make any predictions, so we won't be political. Okay? Let me see. Rob?
Well, during your days when you're working, how many hours do you work and what kind of work do you do while you're working?
Let me give you an idea what my day is like, okay? I'll just go through one day I had this last week. I got up at about 6:30 in the morning, and I have an apartment on Capitol Hill. And I walked, I went from my apartment at 6:30 over to the house gymnasium. We have a gymnasium with a Nautilus equipment and some things, an exercise bicycle and the like. So I went in there and I stayed there from about 7 until about 7:30, 7:45. Had a little workout. I left there and went to two breakfasts. I had two breakfasts starting at 8 o'clock. Went to one at 8, one at 8:30. Got back to my office at 9 o'clock in the morning. Had my staff waiting there, and they wanted to have a meeting with me to talk about what was coming up on the floor of the House of Representatives that day and some problems in the office. So we met for half an hour, 45 minutes, almost an hour. Phones are ringing off the hook. People in Illinois are waking up now. It's an hour later in Washington, so now it's 8:30, 9 o'clock, and they're all starting to call in. They've got their questions and requests and that sort of thing. So then I had to leave and go to the floor of the House of Representatives. We had a caucus, which meant that the Democratic members in my party were meeting on the floor. We sat there for an hour or two and discussed what we were going to do about the Graham-Rudman bill that calls for us to cut back on federal spending. And a big debate was going on. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to get back to the office. I've got a lot of things to do, and it was Thursday when I'd hoped I'd be going home. Just as about the time when I was going back to the office, one of the fellows up in the front of the House of Representatives chamber motioned to me, and I came over, and he said, Speaker Tip O'Neill wonders if you would preside over the House of Representatives for the bill that we're considering this afternoon. Well, you never turn down that chance, folks. And I jumped at it, and I went up there, and he handed me the gavel. And I sat there in that chair from 12:30 until 6:30, 6 hours, while we presided over this debate. I had no idea I'd be there that long. But that was a day that I finished up at 6:30, went back to the office, and the desk was covered with stuff. We had letters that people had sent to me that I had to answer, phone messages that I had to return, a lot of things that I had to look over. So I got out that night at 8 o'clock. Now, I will tell you that night that I did take a few minutes to watch The Cosby Show, which I got a TV in my office, and I thought, I'm going to watch this if I don't do anything else. But that was my day. Started at getting there at 7 o'clock in the morning and left at 8 o'clock at night.
Everybody's hand is waving to things to say, but I think at the end of a congressman's day is a good point to end this program, and I want to thank all of you for writing topics, you kids that are listening. Something, I'm sure many things that have been said in this discussion have triggered your thoughts, and you're going to have plenty to write about. You may want to continue this discussion with your teacher and your classmates before you write, and we'll look forward to whatever you send in. And some of these we'll be reading over the air before very long. Now, you all said you wanted to say hello to your teachers. Okay, Emily?
Hello, Mrs. Goodwin.
Rob?
Hello, Mrs. Kennedy.
Mike?
Hello, Mrs. McGill.
Hello, Mrs. Goodwin.
Hello, Mrs. Ford.
BJ, you got a teacher to say hello to? Your English teacher
will
do.
I guess I had to say Mrs. Goodwin because...
That's right. Mrs. Goodwin was the one that asked you.
Hi, Mrs. Goodwin.
And Dick, do you have anybody you want to say hello to?
I want to say hello to everybody, and I want to ask the teachers if during the course of the school year they'd like me to come visit their classroom. Just give a call to our office, and we'll try to work it in. I do a lot of that, and I enjoy it very much. This was a great program, too.
This got has been a good bunch of kids
here.
And we've got a good, bright congressman, too, and we're proud of you,
thank
Dick.
Thank you.
So thank you.
WSSR Radio has presented Reading and Writing and Radio. Send your writings to Jacqueline Jackson, Sangamon State University, Springfield, Illinois, 62708.